This podcast is part of the Gun Rights Radio Network, podcasting freedom.
The Liberals Gun Corner, a proud member of the Gun Rights Radio Network, hosted by Cowboy T, San Francisco liberal with a gun. This podcast is always available at www.liberalsguncorner.com, and you can email us at cowboyt@liberalsguncorner.com. Howdy, folks. Cowboy T here. Welcome to episode 6. As we all know, there was an election very recently in which the Republicans presented former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney to go up against incumbent Democratic President Barack Obama. Mr. Obama won that race. As a liberal who is not a Democrat, I'd like to take a moment to offer just a little advice to our Republican supporting listeners. Your candidate didn't win this time, and you're smarting right now. It hurts. You're probably feeling, I suppose the same kind of thing that a lot of Democratic white women felt when Mr. Obama beat Hillary Clinton in the 2008 Democratic primary. It's an expected disappointment. Well, now you have a job to do, but it may not be what you think it is. You've got to understand not just what happened, but also the fundamental reason why. And you got to look first and foremost at yourselves before you start looking outside. This can be hard for a lot of people to do. We're humans. Our egos usually get in the way. You know, hey, I've got an ego too, like everyone else, so believe me, I know. But it's still got to be done. The fundamental problem was the choice of candidate during your primary. My Republican friends, you've got to do better. You say you support the Constitution as written? Well, great. I love that. You know, that's the right attitude. Well, at least here in the United States of America, that's the right attitude. But then you've got to pick actual constitutionalists. Unfortunately, Governor Romney happens to be John Kerry II, or at least that's how he looks to me. Well, we know how that ended up in 2004. This was a repeat of what happened 8 years ago. If you want to win, you've got to actually start choosing actual constitutionalists in your primaries. That's of critical importance, and that's how you win. So, some for you to think about with your upcoming next elections. Please consider this. Okay, enough election talk. Let's get on to our main topic. There's a lot of back and forth about something that the Bradys and their followers call
the gun show loophole.
They talk about some, quote-unquote, dealers that don't have to run a background checks to sell firearms at gun shows. They claim this is the source of massive amounts of gun crime. There are also some of my fellow liberals who believe that all sales of firearms should require a NICS background check.
Even if it saves just one life.
What they're all actually talking about has little, if anything, to do with gun shows, but it does have everything to do with something called the private sale. Now, there's some pretty strong feelings about this. So, I figured time to address that here on the Liberals Gun Corner. So that we all know what's being talked about, a little quick background information is in order. And to do that, we got to go back in time a little. Back to
1968.
Yup, the 60s, man. Whoa. After the assassination of Bobby Kennedy in that year, 1968, June to be more specific, interstate sales of firearms became severely restricted by the Gun Control Act of 1968. This was passed in October of that year. Before then, here's how it used to work. Someone could go into the local old Sears or Montgomery Ward department store, or their local hardware store for that matter, and buy any old firearm over the counter. Well, that was legal to own by civilians anyway. We used to do this just like you'd buy a set of pots and pans. This was done all the time in this country. Oh, and mail order was a thriving business, too. You wanted a good, inexpensive .22 rifle for rabbit hunting? Or how about maybe a shotgun for duck hunting or even home defense? No problem. Just looked it up in the Sears catalog, wrote your check, and sent away for it. A few weeks later, the delivery man would show up with your brand spanking new firearm right at your door. This was done all the time. But then,
the 60s happened, man.
And Martin Luther King Jr. got assassinated, many people believe by J. Edgar Hoover's people. And then, Bobby Kennedy also got a bullet and he was killed. Oh, that did it. The result was this law called the Gun Control Act of 1968. Among other things, this effectively killed direct mail order of firearms, which had been a thriving business for decades. People now had to take physical possession at a federally licensed firearms dealer, or FFL. I'm sure you've all heard that acronym. This includes, by the way, interstate private sales. That's interstate private sales. The transaction between two private parties who are not dealers and in different states must go through an FFL, one of these federal firearms licensees. And the FFL must annotate each of these transfers, the legal term for this, in what is called a bound book, which that FFL is mandated to keep for, and I'm quoting the law here, not less than 20 years. This is still the law today. These days, the FFL is also required to do a background check against something called the National Instant Check System, or NICS. We'll just call it NICS. This is done through a federal form 4473. However, one type of transaction doesn't need to go through one of these FFLs. That's the private transaction between two individuals who are not dealers and who are in the same state. That's the key. If you're in the same state, you do not have to do this. That can still be done the old-fashioned way, you know, just like it was done before 1968. It's much like, matter of fact, it's exactly like if you were to sell your stereo system or your chainsaw or your lawnmower to we'll say your buddy, your next-door neighbor, your family member, anyone else. And like selling your chainsaw or your lawnmower, this private transaction of your firearm can happen at your home. It can happen at your local hunting club or moose lodge, if you call it that. Or it can happen at a gun show. Pretty much anywhere. And the Form 4473 NICS background check is not required. Again, just like your lawnmower, your chainsaw, or your cutlery set. This is what the Bradys and their followers have been up in arms about for years now. They believe that all sales of firearms, including intrastate private transactions, should have to go through a Form 4473 NICS background check. It's also what some of my fellow liberals believe, which is why we're discussing it here today. Well, I'm here to explain why getting rid of the private transaction as it is now doesn't make a doggone bit of sense. Matter of fact, it's a terrible idea. The usual argument for requiring the NICS background check typically goes as follows. It's not a major burden. It's not against the Second Amendment. Don't you want to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them? They're basically talking about criminals, the mentally unstable, and unsupervised children. Oh, and speaking of children, inevitably they say this too. Don't you want children to be safe? Ah, yes, the for the children argument. First, let's deal with the not a major burden part. Actually, it is. Unlike a lot of other things, the right to keep and bear arms is actually enshrined in our Constitution. Last I read the Second Amendment, it didn't say a doggone thing about a background check being required to exercise any constitutional right. But, well, okay, if we're going to do that, then how about we do the same thing for, I don't know, owning a printing press or posting a YouTube video? Why don't we require background checks for that? After all, the printed and the spoken word have incited more killings than anything else on the planet. Hitler was one of the greatest public speakers in modern times. Look what he inspired. Abraham Lincoln's words inspired a full-blown civil war in this country. Now, I view him as a hero, as I think all Americans should, but his words nonetheless inspired that war. Killed a whole lot of people. So, should we indeed require a federal background check in order to be published? Somehow, I think the good folks over at ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, and especially C-SPAN would kinda sorta strongly object to that, don't you think? Something, I don't know, about this little thing called the First Amendment. Apparently that matters to some people. Oh, furthermore, we end up with a privacy issue on the part of the purchaser, not to mention an onerous burden on the part of the seller. In order to do background checks against the NICS database, one needs to actually have access to that database to some degree. Duh! So, now we have every Tom, Dick, and Harriet getting access to the NICS criminal database, huh? And the federales who control that database, they're going to be happy with that? I don't think so. The director of the FBI probably ain't going to play that. Also, we have a privacy issue with respect to the person purchasing the firearm. That'd be the buyer. Talk about a leakage of personal information to world plus dog. Jeez. Well, oh, well, so much for privacy. What's next? Oh, and speaking of world plus dog, every Jack, Jill, and Bobby who wants to sell a gun to another private individual, they'd have to keep those records for 20 years. Whoa, hold up now. Can we get a more onerous burden on a seller here? Let's just go through this, okay? Let's go through this. Suppose a crime does occur with a gun that a private seller sold to a private buyer. I don't know, the private buyer goes and shoots somebody, we'll say. The cops show up at that private seller's door. They say, "We demand to see your bound book." The seller replies, well, but officer, I don't have it anymore. Whoops, that's jail time, buddy. Felony. Yes. Some might then respond, but it won't be hard for honest people to keep track of those records. Horse hockey, folks. I've moved several times in my life. Inevitably, something gets lost sooner or later. Sucks, I know, but that's part of life. Those of you who've moved, you try telling me otherwise. I know you lying through your teeth, so don't even try to give me that. You've lost stuff. And let's also remember this little thing called a natural disaster. Y'all remember Superstorm Sandy that just recently walloped holy hell out of both New York and New Jersey, oh, and pretty much the entire Northeast? A whole lot of people lost everything in that storm. Everything. They still can't go home, and it's been, what, 2 weeks? Don't tell me those folks wouldn't have lost their bound books, too, along with everything else they had. Of course they would have. So, yes, it would be a considerable burden for government, for the inherent right of privacy, and for the private seller. Big time. Now, let's take on the keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them argument. Hey, I'm all for keeping firearms from violent criminals. You know, who wouldn't be? The key word here is violent. With very few exceptions, I also don't generally have a problem with felons being legally restricted from firearms ownership. Hey, you make that big a mistake, you got to pay the price. So, that being the case, shouldn't we also do the same for, well, automobiles or kitchen knives? You know, require a background check before you're allowed to take possession to keep people who shouldn't have them from having them. After all, don't these things also cause a lot of deaths? Now, the Bradys will claim that automobiles and kitchen knives weren't designed to kill people like a gun is. Oh, really? So you're telling me the mother who finds out that her son or daughter died in an automobile collision is any happier that it didn't happen by a gun? Somehow, I don't think so. I think she's going to be bawling her eyes out over the coffin that now houses her dead child, no matter how the death happened. Oh, by the way, per the U.S. Department of Transportation, twice as many deaths happen by automobile than happen by firearm. And those by firearm deaths, by the way, that includes when the police shoot and kill somebody, folks. The Bradys don't like to mention that little detail now, do they? It's not in their agenda. Well, we clearly haven't required background checks for automobiles, even though they're party to far more deaths than privately owned guns. A death is a death, folks. You want to stop the most deaths? Hey, I'm with you. Then let's ban the biggest fish. Let's hit the biggest one. Require background checks. You know, NICS background checks for automobiles first. Then you'll have some more logical ground to stand on for doing the same for guns. Again, a death is a death. doesn't make it any less of a tragedy if it's by something other than a gun. It's still a death. When we come back, we'll continue explaining just why getting rid of the private sale as we know it today is a really bad idea. We'll take a break for station ID. Be right back.
The forums are a great place to interact with the podcasters and listeners to your favorite podcast. Visit gunrightsradio.com and click on the forums button at the top of the page and sign up for your free membership. Gunrightsradio.com.
Okay, we're back. We're talking about the private sale and its analogs to other things like automobiles and kitchen knives. We just got through talking about automobiles. The same applies to kitchen knives, so let's talk about them next. The Bradys will also claim that kitchen knives
weren't originally designed to kill people.
Yeah, sure. Tell that to the families who lost loved ones to the Green River murderer, or Jeffrey Dahmer. Or how about William McDonald, known as the Sydney Mutilator? Or it's Coatl Ocampo of Orange County, California, earlier this year. Just this year. Or how about the serial killer 2 years ago who committed 13 knife attacks in Flint, Michigan? And then he did 15 more in the northern part of Virginia. Several of those victims died as a result. So yes, a knife is clearly an excellent weapon. Even the cops say, if you're facing a gun, you might get shot. But if you're facing a knife, you will get cut. And they're right. So, given that, why aren't we requiring background checks for knives? Don't we want to keep them out of the wrong hands as well? If not, then why not? Oh, I'm guessing you don't want to have to do a 4473 form, the background check when you go to the Kmart or the Walmart and buy a set of kitchen knives. But wait a minute, though. It wouldn't be a major burden, wouldn't it? Sadly, there are people who probably would say okay to such a requirement. What's next? Butter knives? Forks? Letter openers? Baseball bats? Imagine that. You're a child in the Little League having to go through a federal background check to play baseball. No, don't dismiss this. Brutalities using baseball bats have been happening for decades, ever since they were invented. Yes, they are dangerous weapons. My dad can tell you a story about that from when he was a boy, so no, you can't just write that off either. See, that's the problem. Where does it end? There's a price for living in a free society, folks. That price is you can't have a nanny state. It was illegal for all those criminals I mentioned previously to do what they did. At least every country I know of, it's illegal, including this one. It's been illegal for decades before I was born to drive drunk or recklessly. But on rare occasions, it still happens, right? Even today. Have additional laws stopped reckless or drunk driving? Of course they haven't. Still happens. Now, fortunately, drunk driving has slowed down. That's a good thing. Yet the laws were already on the books, so it's not like the legal climate changed significantly. So what happened? Why'd it drop? What happened is we did two things. A, we changed our culture over time so that driving drunk is a major social stigma. And B, we started actually enforcing the laws already on the books. That's what happened. It's the same with guns. It's already a social stigma, to say the least, for criminals to arm themselves. And there are already laws on the books to keep firearms out of the hands of criminals. How's about some better enforcement of existing laws first before we run off making new restrictions? Think about that for a little bit while we take a short break for station ID. Be right back.
You can hear Gun Rights Radio Network on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under sources.
We're back. And now, let's talk about the Brady's other big argumentative pillar, the children. My dad and plenty of others of his generation tell me stories of how they used to go into the woods, set up some targets, and do marksmanship practice. In my dad's case, it was with the 3220 Winchester lever action rifle. It was pretty popular back when he was younger. They're still around today, of course, and rabbits continue to get harvested with them. Ain't much changed, huh? The elders have also told me about going to the county fair back in the day. Well, according to them, almost without exception, there was one or two setups with a bunch of 22 rifles. I'm sure you all have heard about this. Typically, the boy would try to win a Cupid doll for his best girl, as they said back then, by shooting the bullseye with said 22. You'd hear the crack of those 22s and plenty of boys trying to win that Cupid doll for their girlfriends. At the county fair, mind you. Kids didn't go ballistic and, you know, go off shooting people. It wasn't even dreamed of to actually shoot a person. It was literally unthinkable. On the contrary, a father would take his son to the local hardware department store to get that shiny new Henry Big Boy, Junior's first gun. They'd ride the bus back, new rifle in hand. Naturally, other adults would see the happy boy with his brand spanking new rifle and maybe engage in a little brief conversation. Something like this. Oh, is that a Henry Big Boy? Junior looks up at his dad to see if it's okay to answer. Dad nods yes.
Yes, sir. Pa just bought it for me.
Looks at Dad. First rifle?
Yep, he's old enough now.
Junior's about to lose his shirt buttons. That's a mighty nice rifle there, son. I still have mine from back when I was your age. Still use it, too.
Wow, really? You mean...
That's right, son. That's a real live adult rifle you're holding there. Mirrored sunglasses just became necessary for the glare from Junior flashing all those teeth. Now, you be right careful with that thing there, okay, son?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Dad's nodding his head in approval at that. Well, all right. Congratulations, son. Now Junior's a little shy.
Thank you, sir.
Now, Dad and the other gentlemen reminisce about their own first experiences bagging some small game when they were that age. Junior's, of course, hanging on every word. Eventually, the bus comes to Dad and Junior's stop. They get off and walk the rest of the way home. Rifle still in hand. Now the other kids are crowding around to check out the new Henry. And don't you think this kid's chest isn't all puffed out like he just got elected president? He couldn't be prouder. His chest is out there so far, he looks like Chesty Puller. And Dad'll be just as proud of the boy when he finally bags his first rabbit for the dinner table. Folks, this scenario wasn't all that long ago. That's how it used to be, not so far back. And no background checks were involved or even deemed necessary. What the hell happened to us where we now deem it necessary? Serious question, folks. What happened to us? I met a guy at one of the local Chipotle restaurants a few years ago. For those that don't know, it's a large burrito chain here in the United States, especially for those especially overseas listeners who don't know what that is. It's basically a fast food restaurant chain. Well, this guy was behind the counter making burritos. It's a younger black American fellow, I'd say in, I don't know, mid to late 20s. I was on the way home from booth duty at a gun show. As is usual when I do gun shows, I happened to be open carrying the hunting revolver that day. Well, this fellow saw that 629 and asked me if I had a lever gun to go with it. Turns out he was himself a firearms enthusiast, recently here from Michigan. He was, you know, when he was a kid, he was on his high school marksmanship team. Apparently they still have those up in Michigan. Loved lever guns. Told me about how his family lived on some acreage there. Their backyard went straight into the woods for a good long ways. And when deer season would roll around, they'd sit on their porches and bag some deer with their 30-30s. Typically 100 to 150-yard shots from the porch. This guy grew up on venison. Did all sorts of target practice as a little kid with his 22 before graduating to the 30-30. He sure seemed pretty well balanced to me. Healthy as a horse, too, from all that organic venison, rabbit, and all that. Folks, as a range safety officer and a responsible adult, at least I like to think so, I fully and firmly agree that younger kids should not be handling firearms without adult supervision. We also need to remember, though, that not everyone lives in the city, or even the suburbs. There are a lot of families that live in the country. We're talking the woods, farmland, the plains, the bayou, arid stretches like out in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. These are places where a lot of people have a lot of land, large swaths of land. Having 100 acres in certain parts of the U.S. is hardly unusual. I can only imagine how it is up in Canada, by the way. For generations, parents have taught their kids, both sons and daughters, how to shoot. Then they give the kid a 22 and tell him, "You go back and bring some food now, and I want every bullet accounted for." Yep, that still happens. Guess what? The kids rise to the occasion and do it. Because, well, that's what's expected of them. The kid might bring back a couple of rabbits, maybe squirrels or groundhogs, a possum or two, or whatever else is available. As they get older and bigger, they start using the bigger rifles, the hunting revolvers and such. Maybe even Grandpappy's M1911 A1 pistol, or if they're really lucky, the M1 Garand from the war. These kids grow up just fine. Sure, they got guns. Of course they do. But they don't turn into serial murderers. They don't go off shooting people. They don't become gang bangers. They don't even have negligent discharges. So, clearly, it's something other than the gun that's turning a lot of kids today into violent thugs. If it's not the gun, then what is it? Well, it's a perfectly reasonable question. Let's address it. Having worked in a school system, I can tell you what it is, actually. I've got a really good idea. It's just what Bill Cosby says it is. A lack of proper parenting. It ain't the gun. My grandpa had 30-06s in his gun rack back in the day. There were no gun safes in most homes back then, including my dad's. They used traditional open wooden gun racks. Y'all know what I'm talking about, the old gun racks? My dad could have grabbed any of those guns anytime, whenever he doggone well felt like it. Never once did any of those guns get used against another person. You didn't use guns to settle your disputes with other kids growing up. That'd kill someone. Instead, here's what you did. You balled up your fists and you two went at it. Then, regardless of who won, you cleaned yourselves up and went home or to the soda shop or whatever. That's because parents did their jobs, just like my neighbors do today. My neighbor's kids know exactly where their dad's guns are, but they wouldn't ever dream of using them in anger, unless their lives depended on it, like, for instance, a home invasion. Oh, if, God forbid, that should ever happen, then woe betide the home invader, because both kids will make short work of the assailant. It's just like that 12-year-old girl, Kendra St. Clair, out in Oklahoma that we talked about last episode. You remember? The one that broke into her home? She ain't the only well-raised kid out here. So, should we keep firearms out of the hands of kids? It depends. Is the kid being raised well with proper responsibility and all? Does the kid have the emotional maturity to be able to handle using a firearm? And are the parents drilling the rules of firearm safety into that kid with no wiggle room whatsoever? If so, then there's no reason to hide the firearms from the kid. Matter of fact, that's the worst thing you can do, hide them. Massad Ayoub, the prominent firearms expert and police chief, he talks about this. You don't want a gun to be the forbidden fruit. That's the last thing you want. Why? Because we all know what happens when something's a forbidden fruit. That's the first thing the kids go for when no one's looking. When the cat's away, the mice will play. So, we gotta do something else. How about this? Set appropriate ground rules and enforce them. You know, that parenting thing. And your kids will end up just like they did back in the day. Or like my neighbor's kids. So, for these reasons, this for the children argument that the Bradys like to use doesn't get much truck with me. It ain't the gun. It's the parents. And when the parents do their job, good things result. Remember, I worked in a school system for nearly 10 years. I've seen this. I knew where my dad's guns were, too. I sure didn't turn into a serial killer or a criminal. We'll take a short break for station ID and continue with this discussion.
Gun Rights Radio Network, podcasting freedom.
Mark, how are you, friend?
Hey, Doc Weston, how are you doing?
You're listening to the Barstool Discussion.
Welcome to Gunsmithing Radio with your host, Fred Zeglin.
You're listening to the Gun Review Podcast, a podcast that is made up entirely of gun reviews from the ordinary gun owner.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here with another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast.
This is Downrange Radio, and I'm your host, Michael Bain.
You are listening to the Personal Armament Podcast, Give Me Some Lumen Show. This is Rob Robidoux.
From the commander's chair of the Rolling Chicken Hammer Love Wagon Studio, it's the Road Gunner Podcast, coming at you with 80,000 pounds of concealed carry.
You're listening to Firearms Cafe. I'm your host, Tony Brown.
You're listening to the Gun Rights Advocates Podcast, and I am your host, Mark Vandenberg.
Welcome to the Practical Defense Quick Tip of the Week. I'm your host, Alex Addix.
Live from sunny Live Oak, Florida, it's the Prolonged Podcast.
Now, your host for the Politics and Guns Podcast, Paul Lathrop.
Hello and welcome to episode 306. Wow, 206
of your weekly Gun Dudes Podcast.
Hello, gunslingers.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jim Fleming, and this is Reloading Radio.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Rimfire Podcast. My name is Ken Kowalski, and I'll be your host.
Shooting the Breeze, the formal gun podcast of WaltNPA.com. I am Walt White.
This is Doc Wesson, and in this episode of the Gun Nation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Armed Citizen Podcast. I'm your host, Mick McCart.
Welcome to the Survival Gun Show. My name is Chip Monk, and I'm your humble correspondent.
Every show on the Gun Rights Radio Network gets support from the network in one form or another, and the network needs your support to keep bringing you these podcasts. Please consider going to www.gunrightsradio.com/donate and becoming a subscriber to the network. A subscription is only $2 a month and does things like helping pay for servers and bandwidth. From time to time, the network receives donated products it uses to give away to subscribers, and this year it has an amazing prize to be awarded to one lucky subscriber. The Masada Yube Group has donated an $800 Mag 40 class to be given away, and all you have to do to be eligible to win the drawing is to be a subscriber to the network. More details to be released soon on the drawing and other prizes. So don't wait. Head over to www.gunrightsradio.com/donate and become a subscriber now to be sure you're eligible to win this fantastic training opportunity. We're back. I've just challenged the whole need for these relatively new Form 4473 NICS background checks. This is what the Bradys crow about, and they call the Brady background checks. Well, as you've seen, I have a rather different view. Now, let's talk about some potential dangers of all this. Yes, there are some. We need to look at them. The whole idea behind wanting to mandate these NICS background checks is, of course, to keep guns out of the hands of those who shouldn't have them, remember? On its face, that sounds like a pretty noble goal. But let's look a little deeper. Unfortunately, gangbangers and other bad folks continue to get guns, even in places where firearms restrictions are especially severe. I'm talking about places like Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, Baltimore, Boston. Goodness, our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Not saying criminals don't get guns other places, like Philadelphia, in a state with what I'd call pretty reasonable gun laws. But the ones I've just mentioned, you know, Chicago and so on, they seem to be the real gun crime hotbeds. But how can that be? You know, given the strict gun laws, how are the criminals getting their guns? After all, isn't it illegal? Simple. Criminals typically steal other people's guns. They run them across state lines, a federal felony. They grind off the serial numbers, another federal felony. They commit crimes, usually felonies, with them. They don't go through legal channels. Some gangbanger kids in Chicago were interviewed recently, anonymously, of course, by some of the press corps. These gangbangers freely told the journalists that they get their guns in the black market. Wait a minute. That sounds kind of familiar. The black market. Oh, that's right. We had a big black market before, didn't we? Yeah, it was back in the 1930s. We called it the Prohibition Era. Gee, didn't work out so well, did it? Isn't working out so well in Chicago or Los Angeles today either, is it? Doesn't seem to work out too well in the UK either. The United Kingdom? They've had major gun restrictions over there ever since 2001, for goodness sake. Folks, do you know that armed crime has nearly doubled every year since then? Only the crooks over there have guns, and they know nobody else does. Now the bobbies, the police over there, are asking to carry guns. This would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. Armed criminals pretty much do whatever they want over there because they know they're in one giant victim disarmament zone. Pick a house, any house, invade it, do whatever you want, because you know the residents can't fight you back. And if the residents do defend themselves, they go to jail for hurting the poor criminal. Yep, that's VD all right. How come the British don't have their guns anymore? What happened? Well, years ago, after some
heinous gun crime,
they started up with gun registration. For those of you in California, you know what this is all about. California requires registration of handguns, and starting January 2014, they're going to do it with long guns, too. Well, the UK also started requiring it. So, when they passed their No More Guns law, Mr. and Mrs. Britain, turn them all in, the authorities knew exactly where the guns were. How come? Well, it's obvious. The law abiders did follow the new gun registration law. If guns from a certain address, therefore, didn't get turned in, the cops would show up, guns drawn, and demand the homeowner's guns. That, folks, is what we call confiscation. If the government knows who has the guns, then the government police can show up there and confiscate them. They can take them from you at gunpoint. Oh, but that's the UK. That couldn't happen here in the US. Like hell it couldn't. It already has. I pick on California a lot because, why? Well, I'm from there. So, of course, I know a reasonably fair amount about that particular state. For those of you who think it won't happen here, get your tinfoil hat off. I encourage you to look up something called the 1998 Confiscation of Certain SKS Rifles. SKSs are semi-automatic rifles that shoot an intermediate-powered cartridge, the 7.62x39 Soviet round. They ain't pretty, but they work well. They're good rifles. Well, turns out that due to California's 1989 assault weapons ban, certain SKSs, specifically those that used detachable magazines, even if all the owner had were the 10-rounders, were all of a sudden newly deemed evil. Ultimately, the state attorney general at the time, who had previously approved these rifles for sale to Californians, reversed his own decision and decided, no, they're evil! Turns out he was running for governor at the time and wanted to look tough on crime. The rifles had been sold for 5 years, from 92 to 97, all in good faith. But the California government officials basically claimed, oops, we goofed, now you're in felony possession of unregistered assault weapons. Voters naturally didn't like becoming instant felons, and they made plenty of noise about it. The California government responded by making a grace period until December 31st, 1999. They demanded that either the owners, A, sell them to out-of-state owners, or B, take them to the local police precinct for disposal. Oh, and you get a voucher for $250. Folks, the rifles had been selling for, and thus had a fair market value of, in the 400s. So now that's a Fifth Amendment issue, namely the Just Compensation Clause. Disposal means destruction, folks. They even threatened to inspect owners' premises to see if this had been done. Remember, they changed their minds and made something legal and already in place in people's homes a felony to merely possess. Now, If that isn't confiscatory, then no, I guess I don't know what is. It'd be like all of a sudden outlawing the San Francisco Chronicle or the LA Times and giving all current subscribers a $2 voucher for the subscriptions. Not only did you lose money under color of law, also known as at gunpoint, but additionally, two newspapers are now gone. And people still think government databases listing who the gun owners are is a good idea? Dianne Feinstein of California is on record as saying the following. Quote, if I could have gotten 51 votes in the Senate of the United States for an outright ban, picking up every one of them, Mr. and Mrs. America, turn them all in, I would have done it. Close quote. This dovetails right in line with a statement by Josh Sugarman of the so-called Violence Policy Center. Quote, we'll take one step at a time, and the first is necessarily, given the political realities, very modest. We'll have to start working again to strengthen the law, and then again to strengthen the next law, and again and again. Our ultimate goal, total control of handguns, is going to take time. The first problem is to slow down production and sales. Next is to get registration. The final problem is to make possession of all handguns and ammunition, with a few exceptions, totally illegal. Close quote. And let's not forget Senator Dianne Feinstein's words just 3 years ago. Let's hear her say them.
And what about President Obama, who NRA supporters like to call the great gun grabber? His website says he wants to make the expired federal assault weapons ban permanent. But the White House doesn't seem to be interested in bringing it up anytime soon.
There's some sense that the president has so many crisis issues on his plate right now, that the idea of bringing up guns, which is considered part of the culture wars, would be such a diversion.
I agree with you. I wouldn't bring it up now.
So you're going to hold off?
That's correct.
And I'll
pick the time and the place, no question about that.
There you have it, folks. The ultimate goal is indeed confiscation. It's their words, folks, not mine. History is replete with examples of how government databases of who has the guns leads to the ultimate goal of confiscation. We talked about this in a previous episode, too, with that fellow from Switzerland. Note that not just California, but also Maryland requires all sales of handguns to go through a licensed FFL, excuse me. This includes the private sale. Maryland alternatively allows them to be processed through, get this, the local state police barracks. Yeah, there's a confidence builder. Sure. But now someone will point out that the Form 4473 background checks and the FFL's bound book do not constitute a database of gun owners, since the background checks themselves are not supposed to be saved, and the FFL, not the government, keeps the bound book. Well, actually, it does constitute a database. Yes, it does. Remember, if the FFL goes out of business for any reason, that FFL is required to send all those Form 4473s to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the BATFE, for storage in one of their warehouses. So yes, it is a database, just not always a computerized one. That's what we call a de facto registry. Furthermore, the background checks themselves are supposed to get deleted immediately after someone passes it. Unfortunately, there have been some instances of those background checks not being deleted. Rather, they've been kept around and shared with state governments in violation of federal law. Oops. So, really, all that any government officials have to do is start visiting FFLs and examining the context of those bound books. Since all FFLs are, by definition, registered with the government, this would not be difficult. Just send folks out. Have them start scanning in pages. Folks, I do computers for a living. Today's portable scanners make this pretty darned easy to do. Just take a year or so to do it. That's not a long time in government ways of thinking. A year is peanuts. They've got the people. Or they've just contracted out, so don't think they cannot do this. They can. Unfortunately, all this makes eventual confiscation a very real possibility. Sad, I know, but nonetheless true. It's already happened at the state level, as we just discussed. That's why we need to maintain the private transaction as it is today. There's got to be some way to keep the government from knowing exactly who has the guns, given the worldwide history, including in the USA, of confiscation. Heck, personally, I think we ought to expand the private transaction to go back to how we used to do it before 1968. I see no reason why a law-abider in, say, Virginia, shouldn't be able to buy a gun from a law-abider in, say, Pennsylvania, without governmental permission. The only people who are going to follow the must-go-through-the-FFL laws are law-abiders. They're the only ones who are going to follow the law. Us folks. With very few exceptions, criminals generally aren't stupid. They're typically not going to submit to background checks. If they do, well, that's the light version of a Darwin Award. And as we mentioned in the beginning of this episode, such increased restrictions will only affect the law-abiders, not the criminals. And therefore, I see no reason to punish law-abiders for the acts of criminals. It won't stop the bad guys. Never has. It'll only hurt the good guys, and I cannot imagine why we'd ever want to hurt the good guys. For these reasons, I consider the maintenance of the private transaction, without government interference or tracking, something that we absolutely must preserve. Once again, it's about the defense of liberty. Do we want a police state where government officials monitor as much as possible? Or do we want liberty? They're mutually exclusive, folks. I choose the side of liberty. This is Cowboy T signing off. Until next time. Till then, safe shooting, and thanks for listening.